All right. Afternoon, everybody. Sorry I was late. My name's Paul. I'm a pathologist here. I do currently my area of practice is entirely limited to dermatopathology, skin pathology. But in the past, I also did pretty much everything, including a focus on thoracic pathology. So you'll see that there are a number of examples scattered through this lecture that involve either thoracic or cutaneous pathology. So this is the first of two lectures. This used to be one lecture. I don't know if you realize, but you know the curriculum has changed and now it's split into two. This first one is a little more boring than the second one, probably. How many of you have experience with the discipline of pathology? Anybody? Yeah, a couple. Right, I recognize you at the back there. Okay, well, so if you know a lot about pathology, you know, break out a pillow or something and take a bit of a rest. Hopefully for the rest of you, this will be not too boring and will lay a foundation that will help you understand the rest of oncology and certainly other areas of pathology. So what we're going to kind of go over in the first half of the lecture series, so today's lectures, we'll probably stop right about there. And we're going to talk about, broadly speaking, what pathology is, what a pathology department like the one here at Roswell does, how we do it, and then this is kind of the worst part, all these definitions and concepts, we'll try and kind of zip through that because that's really deadly. And then we'll talk about, very practically speaking, as a pathologist, how we approach a specimen, and we'll have some pictures of like livers and things like that we'll look at. Talk about how we classify neoplastic processes as pathologists. And then kind of, again, practical terms, how can we tell something's malignant? How does the pathologist make that decision? So, let's go. So as an anatomic pathologist, as a clinical pathologist, what are the data points we're providing to the clinical team? What is our contribution? And this kind of sums it up. We'll come back to this slide later, probably tomorrow, I think, kind of break it down in a little bit more detail. But, you know, one of our first jobs is just deciding if cancer's there or not. The radiologist and the surgeon can suspect there's cancer. Sometimes it's fairly obvious clinically. But ultimately, in almost every case, it's the pathologist that's going to eventually decide if it's truly cancer or not. And then, of course, we have to classify it as best we can. What kind of cancer is it? Because obviously, the treatment is going to depend on what type of tumor it is. And then, increasingly, we're asked to try and predict the prognosis of the cancer to some extent. What can we tell about how this tumor is going to behave by what we see under the microscope or what we see in the molecular lab? Tied to that is identifying the appropriate therapy. Now, to some extent, therapeutic decisions are based on, you know, how advanced the tumor is, what kind of cancer it is, where it's located, and things like that. And more, therapy decisions are based on what is the molecular profile of this tumor. And that all falls within the discipline of pathology. And then ultimately, we often have to evaluate the success of treatment. You treat with chemotherapy and then you resect the tumor. How much of the tumor is dead? Is any of it dead? You know, these are kind of parameters and data points we provide back to the clinical team so that they can decide what to do next. Okay, so the old dictionary definition. What is pathology? Well, essentially it's the study of disease very broadly, both structurally and functionally. And we're going to be, you know, talking mostly about cancer today, but pathology is a discipline that studies all types of disease, whether they're neoplastic, non-neoplastic, infectious, autoimmune, et cetera, et cetera. Deviations from the normal anatomy and physiology, essentially meaning the same thing. Pathology is an interesting discipline, too, because we're kind of a bridge between the clinical disciplines and the laboratory disciplines. And this kind of silly picture of the tree here has pathology as the trunk. And up here we have all those clinical disciplines, radiation oncology, surgery, medical oncology, pediatrics, you know, all of those kind of ologies, dermatology. And at the bottom we have the disciplines of pathology. And as you'll hopefully get a sense as we go through this, pathology really is a very diverse group of related fields, right? So it encompasses everything from the microbiology lab to the transfusion medicine lab to guys like me that just stare at slides all day. All of that is the domain of pathology. So the guys like me that stare at guys and gals that stare at slides all day, we fall into the realm of anatomic pathology. And anatomic pathology and clinical pathology together are the kind of key patient care areas of pathology. And as we'll go through later in the day, or later on Tuesday, We'll talk about the research role of pathology. But anatomic pathology and clinical pathology are separate disciplines, both within pathology. They both have their own board certifications and exams. I'm board certified in both, but I don't do any clinical pathology, and most of the pathologists here at Roswell really just focus on anatomic pathology. And that's kind of what this lecture is mostly going to be about also. Anatomic pathology, in turn, is sort of separated into a few other disciplines: surgical pathology, cytopathology, and what most people think of when they think of pathology, which is autopsy. The truth is, autopsy pathology is a smaller and smaller and smaller chunk of what we do. At Roswell, we only do maybe 20, 25 autopsies a year. At Collida, I think they do probably a couple hundred. Years ago, when I was in training at the University of Michigan, which is a big hospital, but we did maybe 300 or 400 autopsies a year, it seems like the autopsy rate steadily goes down. So it's really, I mean, I haven't personally overseen or done an autopsy in, like, I don't know, years. So it's really not a big part of what we do here. Surgical pathology, however, is. And surgical pathology is what we'll spend most of today talking about. And that's looking at biopsies, looking at full organs that have been removed by the surgeon. It also involves something called frozen section. So let's say one of our thoracic surgeons has a patient in the operating room for lung cancer, and they're going to remove their left upper lobe. And when they remove it, standard of care requires that we tell them if the bronchial margin, which is, you know, the airway that they cut through to remove the lobe, we have to tell them if that's negative for tumor. Because if there's tumor there, they got to go back and take more of the bronchial margin. So we'll actually trim off the end of the airway, freeze it, cut sections right then and there, and call back into the OR and say, yeah, there's no tumor there, you're good, or it's positive for tumor, and then they'll have to go back. And that's what we do up in the ORs as intraoperative consultations. Cytopathology is another part of anatomic pathology. This is the kind of discipline where instead of looking at whole pieces of tissue, they're looking at individual cells in the form of smears or aspirates or liquids. Probably the form of cytopathology most of us would be familiar with would be the classic pap smear to evaluate for cervical disease, right? And that's an example of cytopathology. I know I'm not doing cytopathology justice, but it's a brief summary. Clinical pathology, I'm really not going to do justice because this is a huge area. And as I mentioned, this is all the stuff like, you know, this is the stuff with the labs and the machines and the test tubes full of blood and that kind of stuff, right? So the chemistry lab looking at liver enzymes or glucose levels or electrolyte levels, the hematology lab doing blood counts, that kind of thing. The micro lab cultures identifying microorganisms. Transfusion medicine is a pretty big thing at a place like Roswell. Patients need red cell transfusions, platelet transfusions, that kind of thing. This is all within the realm of clinical pathology. And there are pathologists whose job is really just to oversee labs like this. And at Roswell here, that's Dr. Joanne Becker. I don't know if any of you know her, but she has an enormous task kind of overseeing the entire CP side of Roswell. So, how does all this fit into the actual practical care of a patient? And this is sort of an oversimplified schematic. So let's go back to a patient with lung cancer, because again, it's one of the areas I know best. Let's say a patient has a 30-pack year history of smoking, and he develops a cough, coughs up a bit of blood, goes to his family doctor, sends him for an x-ray, they see a shadow in one of his lungs, send him for a CT scan. They say, okay, there's a mass in there. We suspect it's cancer. We're going to have to do a biopsy. So depending on where the tumor is located, let's say it's peripheral, and they can put a needle in between the ribs, they'll sink a needle in there and pull out cores of tissue. So after the radiologist or the surgeon has done that biopsy, it comes to us in pathology. And so we're going to get these teeny little slivers of pinkish tan tissue in a jar. They'll literally be, you know, a couple millimeters in size. And we'll look at them under the microscope, and we'll say, yeah, unfortunately, it's adenocarcinoma of the lung. Now then, depending on the rest of the patient's condition, you know, they'll do additional studies, perhaps look to see if there's enlarged lymph nodes in his chest. If it looks like it's a surgical tumor, a tumor that could be treated primarily with surgery, the surgeon takes him to the OR, removes, let's say, again, the left upper lobe, And that whole specimen then comes back to the pathologist. Now we have the whole tumor. And that's where we gather a whole lot of additional information about the cancer that will then guide the entire rest of the patient's course of therapy. So we'll not only look at the tumor, see how big it is, see what it's invading, make sure that the surgeon got it all out, but we'll also look at any lymph nodes that are attached to the specimen, see if the tumor has spread to those lymph nodes. As you'll see tomorrow, the lymph node status is a really important prognostic indicator, and it impacts the tumor stage. You've all heard about stage 4, stage 3, stage 2. Well, a lot of that depends on what the lymph nodes are doing. So we'll give them all that information, and then they'll decide how to treat next. Now, increasingly, again, that molecular stuff comes into the picture. If they decide after the first diagnosis that the patient has advanced cancer, surgery might not be an option. And so then we'll be asked to look at those teeny little pieces of tissue, send them to the molecular lab, find out if there's any targetable mutations that we can treat. For example, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, EGFR, epidermal growth factor receptor, is frequently mutated in a subset of lung cancers. It's a mutation that we can target with drugs. So we might skip all of this and go straight to just characterizing the tumor, or after surgery, we may need to if the tumor recurs. Any questions so far? So how do we do all this? Now, again, those of you that have been to a pathology lab know this, I apologize, but it's a bunch of steps, and even some of my clinical colleagues don't really realize exactly what is entailed in this. It ends up being sort of a black box, right? You send your biopsy in, and a few days later you get an answer, and nobody's sure what happened. Well, here's what happened. We have a grossing station. So that's where either a pathologist or a pathology assistant will take the specimen, and it could be anything from those teeny little pieces of tissue to a whole lung or a liver, or sometimes we'll get half a face, or, you know, really depends on the cancer type. They'll take that, they'll carefully examine it, pick the areas we're going to look at under the microscope. We'll talk about all this in a little bit. And then they take those pieces of tissue that they've selected for further exam, and they'll be fixed in formalin. Formalin is 37% neutral buffer formaldehyde, and we use that to both kind of keep the tissue from rotting, which is obviously not good, but it also actually enhances the detail under the microscope. It allows us to see the cells better, which is critical to what we're going to do. So then those pieces of tissue go into the tissue processors, and the tissue processors are these big machines that run overnight. They suck all the water out, and they fill the tissue with wax to make it hard. And then that way we can cut sections, and the sections are really thin, and they get laid on the glass slides, and we end up with the histology. Okay, here's our first gross picture. I like to see if anybody can recognize what this is.
Pancreas?
That is actually a pretty reasonable guess, but not at all right. What's that?
Gastric?
No.
Adrenal?
No. This is a finger. Yeah, I know, it's pretty hard. That's why I like to ask people, because it's almost impossible to get. And I'm mean, I guess. But yeah, this is a finger. This was an amputated finger. So this is where the amputation, you know, this is the surgical resection site, and the finger has been cut kind of in half, right, so we can see the middle of it. It's slightly off to midline because we don't actually have any bone down the middle, which makes it even harder to recognize what this is. But this gentleman had a very black mass under his fingernail that grew quite rapidly. This was a melanoma. Supposedly this guy was like an amateur magician. So I don't, you know, for somebody that's doing sleight of hand, I don't really know how he let this thing grow on his finger, but I think it grew quite quickly. He ended up dying from this melanoma. It was metastatic right at presentation. But this is an example of a gross specimen that we might get. And the pathologist is going to look at this. You know, obviously we cut it carefully into sections, and then we're going to measure the melanoma. We're going to see that it invades bone. We're going to see that it's well away from this resection margin, which is critical to deciding if any more surgery is necessary. We'll take sections of the tumor and all that kind of thing. We'll talk more about that. So we select pieces of tissue. Let's say we, you know, took a piece of this. We put it in these cassettes. And these cassettes are what go in the tissue processors. So they've got little holes in them so the fluids can pass in and out. And these are one of the machines. So a very simple way, or a simple explanation of how these work, is they use a whole bunch of different gradiated alcohol washes that bathe the tissue overnight. Those remove the water, and then they're going to replace it. After getting rid of the ethanol with xylene, they'll replace the water with paraffin, like I said. And then our histotechnologists take these little pieces of tissue here, and these stations are heated, so all these little metal plates are hot. That keeps the wax from hardening. So they can manipulate the tissue while it's floating in liquid wax, and they kind of get it lined up the way they want it. And then they let the wax cool, and then you end up with the tissue, this little tan thing in the wax block there. And we keep those for, you know, decades afterwards. This is a permanent storage. So this tissue's fixed and paraffin embedded. So you see that is FFPE in research papers often, formalin fixed, paraffin embedded. And it's from these blocks that then they cut the sections. So the block's sitting here on this microtome. They turn the wheel, it goes up and up, up and down, up and down, up and down. This is like the sharpest knife blade you'll ever see. And it cuts these thin 5-micron sort of pieces of wax with tissue in them. And they actually take a paintbrush there and float the tissue on little water baths. So they stay flat, and then they just touch a slide to it, sticks to the slide, and you're good to go. So what do we do next? Because the tissue is tan or clear, right? So we can't see anything without staining it. And you all probably have heard of hematoxylin and eosin, the H&E stain. And this is kind of like the foundation of traditional histopathology. So it's two stains, hematoxylin, which stains the nuclear contents, nucleic acids, and stains them purplish blue. So the nuclei in cells are going to be this purplish blue color. And then eosin, which sort of non-specifically stains proteins. In the cytoplasm of cells full of proteins, so the cytoplasm of cells stains pink, like this. So here we have a tumor. I don't remember what kind of tumor it is, but you can see the nuclei are all this sort of dark bluish purple, and they're surrounded by a paler pink color. That's the cytoplasm. So this is just your typical H&E. These are all just inflammatory cells, so plasma cells and lymphocytes and things. But the H&E is not the only thing we use. In the early days of pathology, that was really all they had. And pathology as a discipline was actually invented by surgeons. They were, to their credit, trying to figure out how to better kind of improve their practice, and they sort of developed these tools, and then it became its own discipline later. But these days we have a lot more than just H&E. I'm not going to go into most of these in any detail, but you know, there's flow cytometry if you're dealing with lymphoid, blood malignancies or lymphomas. We have cytochemical stains. Cytogenetics is important, again, often for the hematopoietic tumors, lymphomas, and leukemias. Electron microscopy we don't use much anymore, except in very niche areas. They still use it in kidney pathology, for example. But we are going to talk about immunohistochemical stains. How many of you are familiar with immunohistochemistry? Yeah? Most of you? Some of you? Okay. Immunohistochemistry is a nice kind of relatively inexpensive way to not only tell you what antigens are present in a cell or in a tumor, but where they're distributed to some extent, right? So a cell obviously has a lot of different antigens in it, probably millions. And there are certain that we have antibodies to that we can use in a clinical or research setting. So for example, epithelial cells have cytoskeleton elements called cytokeratins, and mesenchymal cells sometimes cytoskeletal elements called dimentin. And we can stain for those, and it can tell us to some extent whether it's an epithelial cell or a mesenchymal cell. And then more specifically for lymphoid tumors, you know, if you want to know if it's a T cell, you do a CD3 stain, and you can tell if those lymphocytes have CD3 on them. If they do, they're T cells. So you can see there's a lot of different, and this is just a teeny little fraction of the markers. I think at Roswell, in our immunolab, we have something like 120 different antibodies, and then in the research lab, there's hundreds and hundreds more. And if you don't have an antibody for the thing you want to do immunohistochemistry on, your lab can probably make its own. The basic premise behind immunohistochemistry is this, right? So you have avidin and biotin. Avidin is a protein found in egg whites. Biotin's a B vitamin, and they have this really strong affinity for each other. So our antigen are these little circles. The antibody binds to the antigen. And then you have a conjugate of avidin, biotin, and horseradish peroxidase. So this enzyme, the peroxidase, ends up being stuck to the antigen, right? And we put in the substrate for peroxidase, which is 3,3-diaminobenzidine, also known as just DAB. And if the peroxidase is present, you get a brown precipitate. So the cells that are positive for that antigen stain brown. And you can even localize it more than that. If it's the nucleus where the antigen is, you can see the brown in the nucleus and not in the cytoplasm. Or if it's on the membrane, you might see a membrane pattern of deposition. We can use it for a lot of different things. Let's say, and this actually happens quite frequently, and I had this happen yesterday. So I got a biopsy from, I think it was the flank of skin, from the flank of an older man. It has tumor in it. It's not clear where the tumor came from. It's quite possible it's a metastasis from another primary site. It could be from his chest, it could be from his colon, you know. It's hard to tell sometimes just looking at the H&E. So what we can do then is use immunohistochemistry to try and figure out where it's coming from. And we'll talk about that more in a second. Immunos can also help us locate individual tumor cells. And again, this is something that I do routinely. Melanoma, as you probably know, is a very aggressive tumor and it likes to metastasize. And the first place it metastasizes to are lymph nodes. So we'll take a lymph node, do an immunohistochemical stain, and it will allow me to find even one or two metastatic melanoma cells in the lymph node. And that changes the prognosis, it changes the treatment plan. It's pretty significant. Sometimes we use immunos to help us with that question. How aggressive is this tumor going to be? We can tell how proliferative it is. If the cells are all rapidly proliferating, it may be a more aggressive kind of tumor. And then we can identify therapeutic targets, like the estrogen receptor in breast cancer. Right? We have tamoxifen that blocks that. There's no point in giving the patient tamoxifen if the tumor is not expressing the estrogen receptor. So we'll look for it immunohistochemically. This is an example of that kind of tumor of unknown origin question. We have a tumor, and we can start if we know it's a carcinoma. If we know it's an epithelial tumor, we'll do two stains: a cytokeratin 7 and a cytokeratin 20. And depending on how those stains work out, it narrows our differential. If it's 7 positive and 20 negative, it's most likely one of these kind of tumors, and we can exclude other things, right? So we can say, well, it's probably lung or breast or maybe endometrial. It's almost certainly not prostate, right? So that narrows the differential. And then we can do other stains, too, to narrow it even further. If we really think it's lung, we'll do something like a TTF1, which is a thyroid transcription factor. You don't need to remember all this nonsense, but just to kind of give you a sense of how these are used. Any questions about that? So here is an immunostain. This was a case I had probably, I don't know, like many years ago, back when I was doing general pathology. And a patient had an endometrial tumor, so a tumor in the lining of the uterus. She also had a history of breast cancer. And so we could see that there were tumor cells kind of percolating through the endometrium. But it wasn't clear whether it was an endometrial cancer, a new primary cancer in the endometrium, or whether it was a breast cancer. So we did a stain called mammoglobin. And mammoglobin is fairly specific for tumors of apocrine origin, and that includes breast tumors. It also includes some skin tumors. But it shouldn't be positive in an endometrial carcinoma. And as you can see, the tumor cells kind of scattered through here, all picked up, or were all positive for that antigen, and that told us that this was actually an endometrial metastasis of her breast cancer. So a fairly unusual scenario, but the stains allowed us to make the diagnosis. And we use a blue counter stain so you can see the background tissue, right? Immunos are not perfect by any stretch, and you have to be very, very careful when you use them. There's lots of potential for false positives, lots of potential for false negatives. These are just a kind of a few of the scenarios where you can encounter that. You know, sometimes the antigen, tumors don't follow the rules, obviously. Sometimes they're supposed to express an antigen and they don't. And if you're counting on that antigen present, you'll be disappointed and may even end up with the wrong diagnosis. Sometimes the antibody's no good. It's too dilute. The antigen retrieval didn't work. The antibody's expired. Any number of problems there. Even more frustrating, perhaps, are when it's false positive and it sends you down the wrong road. There could be a non-specific antibody binding. There could be some tissues actually have their own peroxidase kind of activity, and you end up getting brown all through the tissue, and it's not really specific. The antigen's not necessarily there. Sometimes you get entrapped normal cells in the tumor, and you think the tumor cells are positive, but it's just the background cells. And sometimes tumors uptake other antigens, too. So there's a lot of potential for problems, and you have to be very careful about how you're using antibodies and immunohistochemistry. And it's certainly not like a silver bullet. Okay, if you thought that was boring, well, now we're really getting bad. This is the definitions and concepts. Does anybody have any questions about that?
How often?
Not all that often.
And is there like a backup thing that you do?
Well, so with each in the clinical lab and in the research lab too, we're always going to be running a control, right? So that helps us diagnose many of the problems, right? So we'll have a positive control and we'll have a negative control. That helps us account for some of these things, like if the antibody's no good or, things like that. Some of these other things are hard to account for, like if the tumor is taking up normal cell antigens, that's pretty hard to account for. Other things you just can recognize from experience. You see that the cells that are positive are much smaller and they don't quite look like the tumor cells, and you say, okay, this is background normal. So some of these scenarios happen frequently, but they're easily solved by an experienced eye. Some of them we control for. Okay, so let's fly through this stuff because it's pretty bad. So tumor, really in its broadest sense, just means swelling. If you say something's a tumor, it doesn't necessarily mean it's malignant. It's just a mass, right? Of course, cancer is derived from the Latin word for crab, originally defined as a tumor with a fatal course and the formation of secondary tumors, metastasis, which is one of those fundamental properties of malignancy. Tumors like to make more tumors like them, and they like to spread. So we talk about different kinds of malignancy using broad terms like carcinoma. Specifically, carcinomas are tumors derived from epithelial cells, right? So the epithelial cells are coming from the ectoderm or the endoderm. Any embryology fans in here? No? All right. Well, carcinomas are derived from ectoderm or endoderm, and the epithelial cells in the body are those that form protective, absorptive, or secretory linings. On the outside, that's the skin. On the inside, that could be the colonic mucosa. It could be the mucosa in your mouth, in your nasopharynx. That's all epithelial. And most epithelial tumors, most carcinomas are squamous carcinomas, or they can be derived from columnar or glandular cells, and we call them adenocarcinomas. Epithelium in the body is almost always anchored to the underlying stroma via the basement membrane. And we'll talk about the basement membrane again in a couple slides. The basement membrane is barely visible here. It's like a little pink line. But you can see how the epithelial cells are all just attached there. They're piled up. They're making some little structures, but they're all kind of stuck to that basement membrane. Underneath the basement membrane, we have other stroma. We have blood vessels filled with blood. We have fibroblasts. We have probably little nerve twigs and things. But the key point is that the epithelium is anchored to all of that via the basement membrane. The other big category of tumors are the mesenchymal tumors. So we don't call these carcinomas. These are the sarcomas. Most of these are coming from the mesoderm embryologically. The big exception would be nerve tumors. Those are also ectoderm from the neural crest. Neoplasia is just a newer abnormal growth. And usually when we say something's neoplastic, we mean it's a clone of cells, so they're all essentially genetically identical, although we all know now that most tumors have multiple subclones. But they all kind of start from the same place generally. And so a neoplasm is a tumor which, growing independently of its surrounding structures, has no physiologic function. This is kind of an interesting and important term that we'll explore a bit further, metaplasia. So metaplasia is when cells in a certain organ change over to another cell type not normally found in that organ. So here are a couple pictures from two people's esophagus. So we have a normal esophagus here. The normal esophagus is lined by squamous epithelium. squamous epithelium is a protective epithelium. It's the same kind of stuff on your skin, in a woman's cervix, in your mouth. Squamous epithelium. This is Barrett's esophagus or Barrett's metaplasia. It's actually this, the pink stuff here is the Barrett's metaplasia, and this is normal. This person's normal is a little bit darker than this person's, but Barrett's esophagus, when you put a scope in the esophagus, has a salmon pink color. So what's Barrett's esophagus? Well, this is what it looks like under the microscope. Here's squamous epithelium. It's thick. These cells are all rigidly connected to each other by desmosomes. And that's the normal squamous epithelium because, you know, you're swallowing things like, I don't know, carrot sticks and chicken wings and whatever. And, you know, you want a thick protective epithelium in there. Barrett's esophagus starts, though, with chronic acid reflux. The squamous epithelium is good at protecting your esophagus from chicken wings, but not so good at protecting it from the acid that might reflux up from the stomach with heartburn or you know, chronic indigestion. So the cell type that's good at dealing with acid is an intestinal cell type. You see these cells have these little blue blobs in them? That's mucus. So these are cells that secrete mucus, and the mucus coats the surface of the epithelium. It's good at dealing with that acid. But these are not normal esophageal cells. So this is an example of metaplasia. These are completely normal. Well, they're not completely normal. They're benign cells. They're not malignant yet. But they're not normal to the esophagus. So that's metaplasia. Now, metaplasia itself can go bad. We'll come back to that. Another term, hyperplasia, is just an increase in the number of cells. So these are normal cells for the cell type. You could have squamous hyperplasia of your skin or your esophagus. They're supposed to be there. There's just too many of them. Again, that's usually a reactive thing. Invasion. So you can use invasion sort of in cancer pathology two different ways. On a very kind of specific level, it's when epithelial cells break through the basement membrane. So you can have carcinoma that's still growing where the epithelial cells normally grow. We call that carcinoma in situ. Carcinoma in situ has no ability to metastasize. It's just where it started. It's not going anywhere. Once it gets through that basement membrane and invades, however, that's when it develops the potential to spread. Kind of more generically, we use the term invasion when any kind of tumor invades an adjacent structure. So you could have a lung tumor that invades the mediastinum. The mediastinum is the space in the chest in between the lungs, right? So the two kind of definitions of invasion. And here's an example of the first kind. So here we have a squamous carcinoma. Instead of having that nice flat bottom like we saw on the other slide where the basement membrane is just kind of like a line, here we see these irregular kind of jagged clusters of cells. They've gone right through that basement membrane. Differentiation. This is another term that we use a lot in pathology. We'll say something's well differentiated or moderately differentiated or poorly differentiated. We're basically saying, how much does this tumor look like the cells that we think it's coming from? If it's well differentiated, it looks very much like the normal cell type. If it's poorly differentiated, it's almost unrecognizable as being that normal cell type. And here's a couple examples. So this is a lung cancer. The normal lung, you've probably seen pictures of. Here's the alveolar walls. They're very thin. You can't really see the pneumocytes which grow on them. Normally, you see like maybe some blood cells. These dark things are macrophages that have picked up all the pigment, probably because the patient's a smoker and they've been inhaling, you know, smoke. But that's what a normal lung kind of alveolar wall looks like. Here's tumor. It's still making kind of alveolar structures. But now the cells are big and plump and conspicuous. But you look at this and you say, well, yeah, that looks like lung. It's well differentiated. So it's a well differentiated adenocarcinoma or bronchioloalveolar carcinoma, BAC. And then you have something that's poorly differentiated like this. This is also a lung cancer. It's also a lung adenocarcinoma. But you look at that and you have no way of knowing. And this is where you might have to use immunohistochemistry to figure out where it came from. If this pops up somewhere else, then you know you're really not going to be able to tell it's from the lung. It looks more like an abstract painting or something. Atypia is another word we use a lot. It just means something doesn't look normal, right? One important point about atypia is that it can be caused by many things. It's not always just cancer. Lots of things can be atypical but not malignant. So cells become atypical if they've been radiated. Cells become atypical if they're really inflamed. Atypia just means they don't look normal, right? Anaplasia, loss of normal form. If we say something's anaplastic, we mean, as pathologists, we generally mean it looks crazy and is probably poorly differentiated, doesn't look like normal cells. So back to dysplasia, which is an important concept. So dysplasia is the abnormality. There's abnormality in how these cells mature, how they arrange themselves, what they look like architecturally, what they look like cytologically. And we grade dysplasia because dysplasia, most forms of dysplasia, are precursors to cancer, to full-blown cancer, okay? And so we'll grade it, and it tells us kind of how close this dysplasia is to full-blown cancer, essentially. And you start out with mild dysplasia, you move your way up to moderate. Once you get to severe dysplasia, you're saying, wow, this is like basically cancer. And in a lot of the grading systems that we use, or a lot of the systems we use for classifying dysplasia, severe dysplasia is the same thing as carcinoma in situ. So it's carcinoma, right, that has not gone through the basement membrane, has no metastatic potential. It's probably thinking about it, though. Dysplasia is pretty much by definition atypical, but again, just because something's atypical doesn't mean it's dysplastic. It could be reactive. Does that make sense? Yeah? So let's look at an example of dysplasia. Here's the inside of somebody's colon. They've washed out the poop, and it's an important point. Here we have a polyp. Okay. Now, there's lots of different kinds of colon polyps, but this particular kind of colon polyp is a dysplastic polyp that we call an adenoma. And here's what that looks like under the microscope. So the normal colon mucosa is like this. And you can see that this side is a lot more kind of dark and blue colored, right? And when you try and figure out why that is, it's because there's a lot more nuclei, and the nuclei are bigger, and there's less cytoplasm, right? And the cytoplasm is what makes it all pink. So the nuclei are no longer arranged in an orderly way. So here's normal colon, and the nuclei are all along the bottom here, okay, like little fence posts. And they all have their mucin droplets. This looks like the Barrett's esophagus, right, because Barrett's esophagus is the intestinal mucosa. So this is normal. This is the dysplastic. So the nuclei are big. They're piled up. They're no longer just a nice little picket fence. A lot of the cells have lost their mucin. Like there's a stretch here where you don't see the big mucin droplets anymore. So the cytoplasm of these cells is no longer normal. The architecture, how they're arranged, is no longer normal. The way the cells individually look is no longer normal. This is dysplasia. Here's another look. Another thing that often dysplasia will do is these cells are now proliferating. And they're proliferating more than normal cells. And so there'll be mitotic figures scattered through here, as evidence that it's dysplastic too. Pleomorphism just means there's variability within a tumor between the cells. Some of the cells might be big, some of the cells might be small. They also may vary in shape. This is pleomorphism. And then obviously malignancy is a tumor, a neoplasm, usually, you know, a clonal, that has the capacity to invade and metastasize. Any questions? So, here we have two tumors. They're both neuroendocrine carcinoma of the lung. So they're both malignant in theory. But they're quite different from each other, and hopefully you can appreciate that difference now, kind of just looking at these histologic sections. This tumor, all of the nuclei are kind of the same, right? They're all like little soccer balls. And this tumor, most of the cells have a reasonable amount of pink cytoplasm. So the ratio of the nucleus to the cytoplasm is still fairly low. They're not totally orderly. They're kind of piling up on each other a little bit. But this tumor overall has minimal atypia or mild atypia. It's fairly monomorphic, the opposite of pleomorphic. This is a fairly low-grade tumor. So this is a carcinoid tumor of the lung, or a low-grade neuroendocrine carcinoma of the lung. This is its big, bad cousin. Small cell carcinoma of the lung is another neuroendocrine tumor, but this histologically looks very different. The nuclei are not at all the same size or shape, right? So, like some of them are really big and dark and kind of, I don't know what that looks like. It's like almost squared off. Other cells are much, much smaller. Some of them have odd shapes, like this one's kind of like long and pointy at the end. So these cells are pleomorphic. This is a very high-grade tumor, and it's very, very atypical. Small cell carcinoma is much, much more aggressive than this. And we can tell that then just by looking at these sections. You know, if I see this under the microscope, I know that the behavior of this tumor is going to be far more aggressive. The patient's outcome is likely to be much worse than this tumor. Both of these tumors could metastasize, but this one is much more likely to do so. Here's another look at the small cell carcinoma, just again to kind of see that cytology. You know, cancer cells, the entire kind of cellular machinery is messed up. So not only are they proliferating, but a lot of the normal kind of cellular functions become abnormal. In the nucleus, because they're proliferating, you know, that you get all the mitotic figures, many of these cells are going to be in the proliferative phase of the cell cycle. The chromatin, often they have too many chromosomes. The chromatin gets all sort of clumpy and dark, so you get these blobs in the nuclei. And you contrast that with these, and they have a sort of more smooth and organized chromatin. These are a couple of mitotic figures. Okay. Any questions about that? So here's now. So let's go back now. We've talked about definitions. We've talked about a little bit about, you know, what things look like under a microscope. Let's go back to the grossing bay. You know, a specimen arrives from the operating room. How are we going to decide what we do next? What is the information we have to gather? So, essentially, you know, when we gross a specimen, what we're doing is dissecting the specimen, describing what we see, and choosing what sections we're going to take to look at under the microscope. What's this? Anybody know? What kind of organ? I hear mumbling, but I can't tell what you're saying. Liver, yes. It is liver. It is part of the liver, not an entire liver. This is where the surgeon has cut through the liver. So it's probably a liver lobe. Obviously, there's this big thing here, which is not supposed to be here, because this is the normal appearance of liver. Okay? So we get this lobe of liver, and what we're going to do on the grossing bay is first put ink on the margin. So we literally paint the margin so that under the microscope we'll see that ink and we can tell where the margin was. Okay, and that's important for assessing whether the surgeon got the entire tumor out or not. Then we'll take like a big knife, and literally for something like this, just kind of cut it like a loaf of bread. We call it bread loafing. So we bread loaf this thing. And then we look carefully at what we see, all these cut surfaces. And in this case, we see a tumor. So we're going to measure this tumor. We're going to measure how close it is to the margin. And in fact, this is one of the things for liver tumors that we do up by the operating room. As soon as the lobe comes out, they bring it to the to our room. We'll cut it up and we'll tell the surgeon, oh, you know, the tumor is 2 centimeters from the margin. The surgeon says, okay, great, I'm done then. Or, yeah, it's like, you know, basically touching the margin, and the surgeon will go back and take more liver. So we don't even need to look at that under the microscope for livers. We'll just kind of measure it. But that's an important measurement. We'll also just look at the adjacent parenchyma. Does it look abnormal? And then we'll look at the tumor itself. Now, this tumor is all kind of pink in the middle. Why do you think that is? I'm sorry? Well, yeah, it's full of blood vessels. And basically, it's because this liver was in formalin for a little while, but not long enough. So the pink is the area that hasn't had enough fixation. When you fix tissue in formalin, it looks quite different. Everything kind of starts to look brown or tan. You lose all the pink from the blood vessels. So this is kind of fixed tumor, and this is raw. And then this stuff here is blood, so the tumor is actually spontaneously hemorrhaged into itself. Those are pools of blood. So we've cut this up. We've looked at the surface. We've made our measurements. Now we've got to pick where we want to take sections, because that's, you know, the diagnosis that the pathologist makes is only as good as what he or she sees. And what he or she sees depends on where the person takes the section. So This is a hepatocellular carcinoma, which is a tumor, primary liver tumor from the hepatocytes, the main cell type of the liver. It's not the only kind of liver cancer, but that's what this is. So the person in the grossing room is going to probably take at least one section of the tumor itself, obviously, because we want to know what it is, right? We want to be able to classify it, grade it, and all those things. Then they'd probably take a section here because they'd say, well, that looks like hemorrhage. Let's see what it looks like next to the hemorrhage. Then they take a section at the edge so that we see the interface between the tumor and the adjacent normal liver. And that can tell us something about how the tumor is behaving too. In this particular tumor, it's very, very nicely circumscribed. It has a very smooth border. It probably has a little bit of a fibrous capsule, which is that kind of thin white there. So we probably microscopically would see a nice sharp cutoff between the tumor and the liver if we took that section. We would definitely take a section of the normal liver because it's important to know if there's any pathology in the normal liver. Does this patient have hepatitis C? Does the patient have developing cirrhosis? Some of those are, like, for example, hepatitis C is tied to development of hepatocellular carcinoma. So it would be useful to see what the normal liver looks like. And then, of course, we take a section of the margin. Just to make sure, it looks like it's pretty far away. We want to make sure there's actually no microscopic tumor at the margin, too, and we would probably take multiple sections from the margin. Okay, what's this?
Guts.
What's that?
Guts.
Guts. Yes.
Colon.
Yeah, it's colon. Yeah, it's a large intestine. And the tumor is right here. So we've cut this open, right? So we're looking at the inside. So this is the colonic mucosa. And here's the margin. And a little probably closer to the margin than you'd like, we have this area where the mucosa itself is wrinkled, kind of pulled in. And if you were to, you know, touch this, these areas would be sort of smooth and soft. And as you got closer to here, you'd start to probably, once like about there, you'd start to feel a little more firmness in the mucosa. And then you get to the middle there, and it's going to be quite firm. And that's where the tumor is. And this is a colonic adenocarcinoma. So what we're going to do in this case is, again, we'll take some sections of tumor. It's very important with colon adenocarcinoma to know how deep it is. So we want to take sections that go sort of straight through like this. So then we'll get a cross-section of the tumor going from the surface here down through the wall of the colon. We'll probably take a couple, or three or four, actually. Then we'll take sections of the margins, because, again, it's kind of close. And, you know, you might guess, let's say, oh, well, it probably ends about there. But often there's tumor cells extending much further than you can see, than you can feel. And so microscopic tumor might even go to the margin. So we'd want to take sections there. I don't know if you noticed, but there was a little polyp right there. There's another polyp there. There's another polyp there. So this, there's another one there, another one there. This patient has a lot of colon polyps, and these are probably the adenomas we saw earlier, and probably this adenocarcinoma started out as one of these adenomas, a dysplastic lesion that became outright cancer and invaded. And then we would take some sections of normal colon too. So in doing all of this, we're kind of asking ourselves some questions. The first thing we're asking ourselves is there even any pathology here? And you better hope that if somebody cuts out part of your colon that there's some pathology there, and there pretty much always is. But that's not always the case, depending on the type of specimen. Sometimes you'll get a skin biopsy and there's no particular pathology there. A skin biopsy is a fairly minor procedure. But you always have to ask yourself that. Is there really even anything here to evaluate? And then you have to say, well, okay, there's something going on. What's going on? It's not necessarily cancer. I see a lot of skin biopsies that are not cancer. It could be somebody with lupus. It could be somebody that has a drug rash. It could be somebody with psoriasis. There's a lot of other types of pathology that impact the skin. Inflammatory, autoimmune, sometimes, you know, infectious. I get biopsies for toenail fungus, you know, lots of stuff. Tinea pedis. But if it is neoplastic, then we have to start collecting all those parameters that we've started discussing, right? You know, we have to decide if it's benign or malignant. We have to figure out what the tumor type is, the grade, the stage, and whether there's tumor at the margin. Okay. So let's go back now to this classifying neoplasia. So we've talked about epithelial cells, carcinoma. We've talked about mesenchymal cells, sarcoma. We'll talk a little bit about hematopoietic tumors, like lymphomas and leukemias. There are other tumor types that don't fall neatly into these categories, but on a day-to-day basis, the majority of the tumors that we see are going to fall into one of these three groups. So the epithelial tumors, carcinomas if they're malignant, are also called adenomas or papillomas if they're benign. We talked about how they can be of different types, right? So if you have a carcinoma arising from squamous epithelium, obviously it's going to be a squamous cell carcinoma. If it's arising from glandular epithelium, like that colon adenocarcinoma or the lung adenocarcinoma, it's arising from secretory or glandular epithelium. We even have neuroendocrine carcinomas, like the small cell carcinoma I showed you. That's arising from a neuroendocrine type epithelial cell. And we talked about how often, but not always, there's a pre-invasive lesion, a dysplastic lesion, or a carcinoma in situ. Here's an adenocarcinoma of the lung, grossly. The normal lung, when you take a lobe of lung out, normally it's full of air, right? When you're breathing, it collapses. So it just kind of looks like a piece of beef or something because all the airways have collapsed. When it's inflated, it's much spongier. But this is obviously abnormal. We have this large, fleshy, tan, pink tumor. It actually has little satellite tumors. Here's a separate little nodule over there. There's one there. So this is an adenocarcinoma of the lung. I don't have any real like point to the slide other than that I like that picture. Here's another example of dysplasia. So we start out with relatively normal bronchial epithelium. It's not completely normal, this epithelium. There's a little bit of hyperplasia of the epithelium, a few too many cells. This is from the lung of a smoker, so this is the earliest change, the earliest damage resulting from that smoke. You can see the little cilia, the hairs at the top there, some mucus cells. Well, another form of metaplasia is the metaplasia that occurs in the airways of long-term smokers. And it's the opposite of what we saw in Barrett's esophagus. So this, which is a glandular columnar epithelium, turns into a squamous epithelium instead of the other way around, which is what we saw in Barrett's, right? So now we have squamous metaplasia. And if the smoker continues to smoke, over time, some of these cells start to go bad. They start accumulating a mutational burden, and you start to develop dysplasia. In this particular case, this dysplasia is sort of vaguely still recognizable as being squamous. It's still bound by the basement membrane, so it's not anything invasive, but this is carcinoma in situ. And then this is just a picture of, you know, if it went bad, it became invasive squamous carcinoma. One of the hallmarks of all epithelial tumors is they express the cytokeratin intermediate filaments. So that's something that we use a lot. If we're trying to figure out if something's an epithelial tumor, we'll do a cytokeratin immunohistochemical stain. And as we talked about earlier, the pattern of cytokeratin expression can tell us a lot about what kind of tumor it is. Mesenchymal tumors, if they're benign, we put an oma on the end. If they're malignant, we put a sarcoma on the end. And really, it's just they're classified by what the cell of origin is. So if they're coming from smooth muscle and they're benign, they're a leiomyoma, like a uterine fibroid. Right? We've all heard of fibroids. Well, those are benign, smooth muscle tumors of the uterine wall. Those are leiomyomas. If they're malignant, then they're a leiomyosarcoma. Cartilage, when it's benign, is a chondroma. When it's malignant, it's a chondrosarcoma. Here's a chondrosarcoma. So this is from the humerus, from the arm. This is the thick, outer, hard cortical bone. So again, this is like cross-section, right? And then at the tip of the humerus here, we see that the normal cortical bone is starting to become thickened and replaced by this silvery, glistening, slightly wet-looking material. And this is the chondrosarcoma. And it's growing not only in the cortical bone, where it's destroying the cortical bone, but it's growing through the center of the bone in this sort of spongy, cancellous bone and bone marrow. It's being replaced by this chondrosarcoma. So this is a malignant tumor of cartilage. Normal benign cartilage looks kind of similar, grossly. It's kind of that got that grayish, slightly wet look to it. Unlike the epithelial tumors, the sarcomas don't express cytokeratin usually. Instead, they'll express vimentin. So if we're really stuck and we can't tell if it's epithelial or mesenchymal, that would be a reasonable starting point. You do a cytokeratin stain and you do a vimentin stain. And then sarcomas are a really complex group of tumors that are very hard to tell apart sometimes just by H&E, and we use immunohistochemistry a lot in diagnosing sarcomas. And again, there are lots of specific markers we can use that can kind of tell us, is this a smooth muscle tumor, or is this a nerve tumor, or is this a vascular tumor, or what is this? The other big group that we'll just touch upon are the blood tumors, the leukemias and the lymphomas. It's 5 o'clock. We're almost done. So these are the tumors that are derived from bone marrow cells, right? So the lymphomas usually involve lymph nodes or other lymphoid tissue like the spleen or the lymphoid tissue of the colon or the skin. And the leukemias are the tumors that are circulating in the blood. They can be lymphoid or myeloid. This is a mucosa-associated lymphoid tumor of the lung, lymphoma. So we've seen some pictures of carcinomas. We haven't really seen any histologic pictures of sarcomas, but what you notice here is all these tumor cells, they don't really have any structure. They're just kind of growing as these nodules. They're not organized at all. We look a little closer. They're fairly monotonous. They're completely just sort of like growing through the existing lung. And that's fairly characteristic of many lymphomas. They don't form structures because some types of lymphoma will recapitulate structures from a lymph node, but a lot of time they just grow in sheets. And we can classify the lymphomas based on what kind of cell type they are. And to some extent we do that based on where they originate within a lymph node. So this is actually a germinal center. Have you seen germinal centers in lymph nodes? What that looks like? I just threw this slide in because I had to turn an hour and a half lecture into 2 hours. And I probably should have given you a picture of a germinal center. Live and learn. In any case, within a germinal center of a lymph node, there are different populations of lymphocytes. And when they go bad, they form different types of lymphoma. So, for example, the mantle zone here is an area sort of towards the periphery of a germinal center. And that's where mantle cell lymphomas come from. Further out from that is the marginal zone, and that's where the marginal zone lymphomas come from. In the center of the germinal center is where we get follicular lymphomas. And we can kind of then figure out what type of lymphoid cell they are by looking at their immunohistochemical patterns. So we know they're B cells because they're CD20 positive. We do a BCL6. And if it's positive, we can figure it's coming from the germinal center. I think this is the last thing. So we know something's a lymphocyte, or we know something's an epithelial cell, or we know something's cartilage. But how do we know it's malignant? Well, there's a variety of ways we figure that out. And there isn't always one kind of simple sort of clue that tells us. To some extent, it's just how it grows. What does it look like? Both how it grows when you look at it grossly or by radiology, and how it grows when you look at it under the microscope. So how closely does it look like normal tissue? The less it looks like normal tissue, the more likely it is to be malignant, essentially. What's the contour? Benign things tend to be nice and even and circumscribed. That hepatocellular carcinoma we saw, that was malignant, but it was well circumscribed. So this by itself, any of these by themselves, don't tell you if it's malignant. But you put it all together and you can kind of figure it out. Does it invade adjacent tissue? Does it invade blood vessels or nerves? Does the tumor have a capsule? Here's a mammogram. Okay, so x-ray of breast tissue. The fibrous, the more dense tissue, is white. And here we have a discrete nodule. And even in the mammogram, you can see it has angulated kind of irregular contours. So that's worrisome. That suggests it could be malignant. And if the surgeon then does a lumpectomy and we get a specimen like this, we have that tumor right in the middle. Again, you can see that it has irregular kind of jagged infiltrative edges. That strongly suggests that it's malignant. It's certainly an important data point in making that distinction. If we look at that breast under the microscope, benign breast looks like this. It's organized in a predictable way. We have these terminal ductal lobular units, where we have kind of branching tubes leading up to the end lobules. So the mammary secretions are generated by these cells, and they empty up into these tubes, and the tubes empty into bigger tubes, and ultimately out. And so the important thing to recognize here is how these are making nice little organized kind of circles. And the stroma itself is just bland pink collagen and fibroblasts. Well, this is a malignant breast tumor. We no longer see those nice organized terminal ductal lobular units. We see tubules just growing wherever they damn well please, into the fat, through all the fibrous tissue, into the wall of this blood vessel. So that's that growth pattern, that architecture tells us this is malignant. We also have a change in the stroma, which is helpful too. See how it's kind of gotten all sort of bluish-gray looking? The stroma is very different from the benign stroma. It's got a lot more blood vessels. It's got myofibroblasts. It probably has some, you know, mucopolysaccharide in it, and it's changed its composition. Another way we recognize malignancy is by just simply seeing how quickly the cells are proliferating. Obviously, that's one of the hallmarks of cancer, right? The cells are proliferating out of control. We can count mitotic figures. We can look at the mitoses themselves and see if they're normal. Malignant tumors often have abnormal mitotic figures, so they don't just go through normal prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. They might pull off in multiple, three or four different directions. They probably have too many chromosomes. That can tell us if something's malignant. We can just see what the percentage of cells in the proliferative phase of the cell cycle is. Another thing we can do is look for necrosis, because a lot of times malignant tumors are growing faster than their blood supply will allow. When you run out of blood, you die. So you'll get areas of the tumor that are just necrotic because they outgrow their blood supply, or the cells are just so messed up that they can no longer remain viable and they just necrose that way. So this is a hepatocellular carcinoma, and down here we have an area of necrosis. These are all the tumor cells. You can see this area down here looks different. The nuclei have become dark and they're fragmenting. The cytoplasm is a slightly different color. There's neutrophils in here as a response. This is what necrosis looks like under the microscope. This tumor, this hepatocellular carcinoma, is also very, very mitotic. Beside each one of these stars is a mitosis. This one is sort of abnormal. So there's a lot of evidence that this is malignant. And then, of course, we look at the cells themselves. These are ugly-looking cells. We talked about pleomorphism. We talked about atypia. All of that is going on here, too. If you really want to kind of break down what atypia means, we look at the nucleus, for example. What does the chromatin look like? Is it smooth and even, or is it dark and clumpy? Do we have nucleoli present? Do they look normal? Is there more than one? What is the contour of the nuclear membrane? So if you look at the membranes, the outermost part of these nuclei, they're actually quite thick. Many of them are regular. Those are all atypical features that help us decide that this is malignant. The ratio of nucleus to cytoplasm. Big nuclei, not much cytoplasm. That's an atypical feature. And we also look at whether the cytoplasm is mature. If you remember the colon adenoma, a lot of the mucinous cells, mucin droplets were gone. The cytoplasm was no longer mature and normal. All right, this is the last slide. I'm tired. Benign or malignant? Which one's malignant? One. Yes. Correct. This is benign liver, and this was, I believe, also hepatocellular carcinoma. Whew. Okay. Any questions? Hopefully the next lecture is a little more interesting. I'm a little less like burnt out. Yes. Yes. Well, okay. Yeah, maybe I was confused. Yeah, the nucleus, the nucleus gets bigger and there'll be less cytoplasm, so the NC ratio increases. Yes. My mistake.